It's Twin Bills, the Red Sox podcast from the sports department of the Providence Journal, featuring Red Sox beat writer Bill Koch, along with sports editor Bill Corey. Now, Twin Bills.
Hello and welcome to this week's Twin Bills Red Sox podcast. This is Bill Corey, the sports editor of the Providence Journal. With me is sports writer Bill Koch. Bill, this doesn't seem right. It's just about All-Star weekend, and it's cloudy out. There's kind of a cool breeze. Weather forecast seems is calling for rain. All-Star weekend is supposed to be blazing hot, sunny beach and boating weather. So I feel like I'm getting shortchanged here.
Have no fear, Bill Corey. We live in New England, which means if you wait 5 minutes, you may get some of that blazing hot, sunny, beachy boating weather in no time flat.
Yeah, it's been that way this last week. It's been crazy hot and then cooled down, and now we're getting ready for the after effects of a hurricane from down south. But be that as it may, we are here to soldier on and talk about the Red Sox as they head into the All-Star break. So, Bill, why don't we start with how well the Red Sox have been doing now that the break is almost upon us? Not quite. They have a 3-game homestand with the Philadelphia Phillies before that happens. But at this point in the calendar, the Boston Red Sox are still in the driver's seat in the American League East. They are 2.5 games up on their nearest competitor. That is the Tampa Bay Rays. They are 54-34. Bill, and it's as Yogi Berra is known for saying, whether he actually said it or not, I'm not sure, but it gets late early around here.
Yes.
And what that means is if you are the Tampa Bay Rays, the Blue Jays, the Yankees, and, well, the Orioles are. The Orioles may not even be playing, may not even be not worth even mentioning as in terms of competitors. But the rest of the American League East, if you are trying to get to the top of the division, your chances are getting slimmer and slimmer. And for the Red Sox and their fans, things are looking better and better here with each passing week.
Yeah, we've talked about it quite a few times on the podcast in the past. Even though as journalists, math tends to make our heads explode a little bit.
We have these phones now that do all that stuff for
us. Yeah, before the podcast, I was trying to do some remedial calculations, and Bill Corey was watching the smoke come out of my ears.
Yeah, it was tough.
It was tough. It really was. I was struggling with it. But the math becomes prohibitive when you are a certain number of games behind with a certain number of games left. You just, quite simply, you run out of time to catch up. And, the Red Sox right now, sitting at 54-34, 20 games over .500, could move to a place at 100 games, 110 games, 120 games into the season, where if they're able to sustain this pace, they could be able to close out some of their potential wild card and AL East rivals for a division title.
Yeah, it would take an enormous turnaround and falling off the table for them to not finish in the top one or two spots in the American League East. Obviously, the Rays are still pesky enough to be hanging around, but we'll see. With the injuries that they've been dealt, how they'll fare. So, Bill, with All-Star weekend upon us, let's take a look at the Red Sox All-Stars, and they now have 5 All-Stars who are planning to make the trip to Coors Field in Denver. I would say 3 of them are no-brainers in that it's Devers, Bogarts, and J.D. Martinez, and then Matt Barnes and Nate Eovaldi have also been added. So a pretty good representation, healthy representation from the Red Sox. And if I remember all the hype I've been reading, this is the first time that the Red Sox have sent both the shortstop and the third baseman to the All-Star game as starters. Certainly a tip of the hat to Bogarts and Devers. But Bogarts, Devers, and Martinez, those three people are largely the reason why the Red Sox are in the position they are in so far this season.
Yeah, no question. The middle of that order has been driving the offense throughout. They all have an OPS over .900. All have been elite at their positions. Obviously, Bogarts at short, Devers at third, Martinez is the DH. All among the leaders in wins above replacement at those three spots. So you look at those three guys and you just think of how special they are. right, you know, how much they contributed in 2018 when the Red Sox won a title, you know, how much they're contributing now, and especially as we've talked about, Martinez getting himself back on track after a really brutal 2020 has been so important in just allowing the other guys to settle in and be who they are. You're seeing Bogarts emerge as one of the young stars in the game, one of the best leaders in the game, and obviously Devers at 24, not just for his age, but you know, just in terms of third baseman elsewhere in baseball, is certainly a top five player at that position at this point.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the offense really has not been much of an issue for the Red Sox. They've been steady. They've been getting contributions from not only those three guys, but, you know, Alex Verdugo has been pretty consistent for them. Obviously, Hunter Renfroe has come on very strong as of late, for 2 months now. And they've been getting a little bit of pop from the bottom of the order as well. So that lineup really, I think, surprised people, surprised me for sure. But the pitching, which was in a little bit of a funk, seems to be showing a little bit of some signs of life here lately. Pivetta got back on track in his last outing. Garrett Richards, who was looked like he was heading towards a long lull, seemed to kind of, well, I would say he survived his last outing.
That's fair. Okay. Fair.
What are we making of the pitching staff so far? Obviously, Eovaldi has been very good. You know, he's had a few up and down moments, as I keep saying, but overall very good. He's obviously going to the All-Star game. But what do you make of the pitching staff here as of late?
Yeah, the starters were a little wobbly in June. It was their worst ERA by month, by a considerable amount. And if you compare it to what they did in March and April, they were much worse. Now, there could be other factors in there, whether it's the sticky stuff, the crackdown, the weather getting a little warmer,
right?
Them playing better opponents. There's certainly a lot of reasoning behind the fact that their ERA went up so much that they were less effective. You could also point to the fact that maybe some of these guys just regressed to who they've been over the course of their careers.
They're playing to their cards, so to speak, right?
Yes. When players struggle, they often say, well, just look at the back of my baseball card, and that's eventually who I'll be.
That's who I am.
At the end of the year. But when they're cruising along and they're an all-star out of the blue, they'll just say, yeah, you know, I figured some things out. I really got it going. You know, I think I can sustain this. And it's like, what happened to that baseball card theory where you're going to go,
right.
they don't like it on that side. but they did have a stretch of six starts, beginning with Perez and ending with Perez, where the starting rotation had a 1.26 ERA.
Wow.
That was through July 6th. Eovaldi had a scoreless start. Rodriguez had a scoreless start. And then Pivetta had a scoreless start,
yeah.
Seven innings, no runs. Richards obviously was the guy who you're sort of looking at and thinking, you know, he sort of admitted that he's had a problem here, mm-hmm. that he's had to do some things differently, that he's had to give up sunscreen and rosin. He's trying to throw changeups now. The spin rate on his curveball is way down. In Oakland the other day, his first inning, second batter, he hits Elvis Andrews in the head.
Yeah, right on the bill of the cat of the helmet there.
On the brim of the helmet, and the look on his face said, I don't know where the ball's going.
On Richards' face.
I don't know where the ball's going. What's going to happen here? Huh. I'm really scared. And I was an inch away from ending this guy's career because I can't grip the ball and I have no idea where it's going and I'm trying to make these changes on the fly. He looked helpless. and that outing could have really gone off the rails. It didn't.
No,
so credit to him.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, credit to him for figuring it out, for being a professional, for not burning down the bullpen, you know, for a day in the middle of the road trip.
Yeah.
Credit to him for that. And hopefully that's something he can take forward going into the All-Star break. He starts against the Phillies on Friday. That'll be his last start of the first half.
Mm-hmm.
They've pushed him back to fifth coming out of the break. He'll be at the back of the rotation.
Right.
So maybe he takes a little extra time. He can throw a couple more bullpens. He can get a little more comfortable with his changeup, a little more comfortable with the baseball in his hand, because he's clearly the guy that you would worry about right now out of the five. And that's saying something when you consider, you know, how difficult it's been for Eduardo Rodriguez, his peripherals being what they are, the contact being what it is.
Yeah.
I know he got beat by a bunch of bloopers in Anaheim the other day. But the fact is, he still struggled by the standard he set in 2019.
Yeah.
So you wonder where this rotation is going to go. I think they were always the question. Eovaldi, in terms of his all-star status, turned in two really good starts before the team was selected. It was good timing. He ends up right now, he's fourth in wins above replacement among starting pitchers, according to Fangraphs. The other guys on the list, you might have heard of these guys, Bill. Jacob DeGrom, Zach Wheeler, Carlos Rodon.
Yeah, they ring a bell. Yeah,
Kevin Gausman, Brandon Woodruff right behind him. So an elite season for Eovaldi, a payoff for the contract he signed after the 2018 World Series. The fact that he's been healthy and been able to take the ball every 5 days. I don't think ability has ever been in question. I think it's been a matter of whether or not he could just get himself out there.
No, I mean, we've been, I don't want to say I've been surprised, but I have been a little bit surprised, I guess, the fact that he's been so durable so far this season. Now, look, we still got a ways to go here, and we shouldn't count our chickens before they hatch, but so far, so good. He has not had that nagging injury that's knocked him out for a month or made him miss two or three starts or whatever it is. So hopefully his good health and good pitching continues here into the second half. And, you know, Bill, we were all kind of waiting for the Chris Sale return, and he seems to be on that steady path back probably at some point early to mid-August if nothing goes awry. And, you know, we've said this all – we've said this all season long. You know, we can't really count on Chris Sale becoming Chris Sale immediately.
Right.
But, you know, let's say he's okay.
Right.
That's all of a sudden the staff doesn't look, you know, so bad. I mean, not that it looks bad, but you've got Eovaldi at the top of that staff. You've got Pivetta hopefully continuing to kind of figure things out and being consistent. And if you add Sale to that mix, boy, you may have three solid starters. And, you know, we certainly hope that that Erod kind of figures it out, but it could be, you know, that the addition of a Chris Sale, again, we don't know what it's going to be, but it could be it could make the difference down the stretch and into the postseason.
Yeah, Dave Bush, their pitching coach, was available before Wednesday's game, and you know, I think he sort of struck the right tone when he said, "Look, this guy hasn't pitched in 22 months. We expect him to be a little rusty eventually when he gets out there." He's got one session of live BP remaining, and then he's going to go into a rehab assignment. And they want to, according to Bush, they want to properly build him up to the point where he's a starter. That means five or six innings. Now, if you look at what he's done so far, his live BPs have been 20, 25 pitches.
Right.
They've been one up and down, as they call it.
Yeah.
You warm up, you throw the first inning, you sit,
yep.
You get back up.
Yeah, you try and simulate the workload to some degree.
Correct. So you get up to 20, 25 pitches. Now, you look at his rehab assignments and you think, okay, how much time would it really take for him to build up to 80, 90 pitches, you know, which would be five or six innings in a game? I don't think they're going to add 30 right away.
Right.
You know, I don't think it's going to be increments like that.
Yeah.
I think you're probably closer to 10 or 15 per start. And if that's the case, he'll need at least three or four. You know, if he takes five, that puts him all the way to 25, 30 days. You're looking at a month.
Yeah.
So if he starts a rehab assignment next week, let's say, that's the middle of July, that'd put him on track for the second, third week of August, you know, somewhere between the 8th and the 15th.
Right.
Something like that.
Right.
You know, he comes back and he'd make seven or eight starts, give or take, down the stretch.
Yep.
And even if he's 80, 85% of the guy who pitched in 2017, he upgrades this rotation immediately. He'd give them a major lift in terms of morale. You know, in the clubhouse, you see that guy back out there. When he has it going, you're thinking, hey,
sure,
look at what we just added. You know, this is big. You know, a lot of teams wouldn't be able to pull in somebody like this for the stretch run. And we had him just sitting here all along, just chomping at the bit, waiting to get back out there.
Sure would be nice if we were able to go to Pawtucket and watch Chris Sale rehab, wouldn't it?
But that's another
podcast. But
that hurts.
But yes. So in terms of his rehab assignment, Bill. So is that something that he would basically be bouncing around and finding live games to throw at, or would he basically stick with the Woo Sox, you think, and face AAA hitters?
They want him in Pawtucket. Pawtucket.
Right, we want him in Pawtucket.
Wow, I really just did that.
We want him in Pawtucket.
I really just did that.
He would be alone if he was there.
Wow, I said that. That was terrible, wasn't it? They want him in Worcester, and they want him in Portland, primarily because they want him close to Boston and the medical staff.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, they want to evaluate him the day after he throws, maybe 2 days after he throws. They want to see his recovery. They want to see his, you know, his workouts in between starts. They want to monitor those very closely. You know, I'm sure that in Worcester and in Portland, they'd have technology set up with respect to TrackMan and Rapsodo.
Yep.
You know, it would lessen his travel. He wouldn't be going to Greenville or Salem, you know, pitching an A-ball. He wouldn't be in Fort Myers in a backfield, you know, and then coming back to Boston to be evaluated. It would be as simple as, you know, getting him in a car and driving him out to Worcester or driving him to Portland.
You mean he doesn't drive himself?
I mean, he could. he seems like, you know, he's Florida, you know, Florida man.
Right,
you
right.
Know?
Yeah, I'm sure he's going to get into his Ford pickup and drive out to Worcester, right?
That's probably exactly right. What it is. You know, Florida Gulf Coast guy. He was not an SEC or ACC recruit.
Right.
He did not have bouquets of flowers thrown at him coming out of Lakeland High.
Yeah.
You know, and bags of, you know, perhaps some green stuff in there.
Yeah.
You know, cash. Folks, cash, because the ACC and the SEC are scrupulous recruiters.
Right, they never break a rule.
Never happens. But I think they want to keep him close, and I think it has to do with the facilities, and I think it has to do with proximity to the medical staff. You know, and then ultimately they could decide to activate him, you know, either during a homestand at Fenway or, you know, ahead of a road trip that they go out on in August. Mm-hmm. You know, so that would be a big lift. You know, certainly you wonder what they do with the rotation in terms of, you know, who drops to the bullpen. Do they go to six men? Do they try to get guys extra rest into September, being mindful of the fact that no one really pitched in 2020?
Right.
And that they're already way past their innings thresholds, pitch counts from last season, that we're entering sort of unknown territory here in terms of how bodies will react after being disrupted so much.
Sure.
Over the course of a year, 18 months. You know, so that's something that Alex Cora has mentioned, the fact that they could go to a six-man rotation. They could piggyback some starters, whether that means they bring up Tanner Houck and they have him go multiple innings behind a guy. They add him in with Garrett Whitlock, who's already sort of going multiple innings behind a guy. You know, maybe they do something like that. They're going to get creative here over the last two and a half months. I think you're going to see some things that maybe they haven't done before. And I think that's in response to the fact that 2020 was such a different year, and that they want to be sure, if they're on track for October, like they currently are, that these guys are able to perform when the games mean the most.
So the All-Star break is coming at a pretty good time, I think, for some Red Sox players, and that's those players that are on the IL. Danny Santana, who is not, but obviously is dealing with an injury. Kevin Plawecki, Marwin Gonzalez. So, Bill, do we think we're going to be seeing some more call ups? Obviously, we saw Connor Wong come up recently. Had a nice late inning hit a couple of games ago and threw out somebody trying to steal second. Are these long-term concerns, or you think it's just banged up and they'll be ready to go kind of early after the break?
I mean, you certainly have some nagging stuff going on there. Santana, you know, was favoring his left quad running down the first baseline the other night. Marwin Gonzalez left the game in Anaheim with right hamstring tightness. You're always curious in terms of lower body injuries, you know, just how much you can push it,
right?
How much you should push it, frankly. Yeah,
those are the kind of things that can just nag you for the rest of the year. You're never quite right, so you know you don't want to come back too soon. You know, you might feel good one day and not so good the next day. They're tough.
And you add on to that that they look at Santana as a guy who's going to make his living with his legs, who's a runner a little bit, you know, can steal a base here or there. You know, so they really don't want him out on the bases thinking, yeah, I'm going to go first to third on a single to center, or I'm going to try to steal second in a big spot. That could be his natural instinct.
Yep.
But his body might say, hang on, Danny. You have a problem here. You can't do that.
Right.
And suddenly that turns into you know, a 3 or 4 week injury, and that's not what they're looking to do. You know, now you the counter to that might be those guys shouldn't be playing anyway. You know, they both have a sub 600 OPS. Why are they taking a bats away from someone who could improve this team? Mm-hmm. And I think this is where Jaren Duran is called to the ring, you know, because certainly Red Sox fans are clamoring
for him. We've been hearing that name for a while now.
You know, and now they do have an open spot on the 40-man, which is convenient because if they do choose to promote Jaren Duran, he is not currently on the 40-man roster. They have not had to put him on yet. His draft class does not have enough service time where he would be exposed. They put Eduard Bizzardo on the 60-day IL. They transferred him. He has a right lat strain. And that was sort of a paperwork thing, a service time thing, where he was on the 60-day in the minor leagues, and now they've put him on the 60-day in the major leagues because they passed a certain service time date where he's not accruing at this point. And they also open up a 40-man spot by doing that. If you're on the 60-day IL with the major league team, you are taken off the 40-man roster. Like, Chris Sale is not on the 40-man right now. Mm-hmm. Ryan Brazier is not on the 40-man right now. They would have to be put back on the 40-man if they were activated by Boston. So that's just a little administrative stuff. That's something that front offices keep in mind. They sort of stash a guy. They have sort of a shadow roster spot, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. They've opened a place for Duran to come to Boston. And you look at the fact that he wasn't selected by Team USA for the Olympic team after he played in the qualifiers, which certainly suggests that there was communication between Team USA and the Red Sox that said his call-up might not be imminent, but he is certainly high on our depth chart. And if we'd like to bring him back and you have him in Tokyo, you're going to lose a player.
Yep.
And we're going to deal with 2 weeks of quarantine and someone who is exposed in Japan to COVID-19 and, you know, somebody who might not have had regular bats and who's traveled however many thousand miles on a couple plane flights. And maybe it's going to take us a couple weeks to get him going again.
Right. Translation, please don't take him.
Please don't take him. You know, the other guy that you're certainly going to look at is Franchi Cordero, who has been playing a little bit at first base in Worcester, made his first professional start there earlier this week, in 33 games at Worcester since his demotion. He has a 1071 OPS. So you're looking at Franchi Cordero and you're thinking, okay, they traded for this guy. They obviously saw something in him. He's someone who's on the 40 who could be promoted at any time. Is he suddenly a platoon option with Bobby Dalbec at first base, who could play a little bit of outfield on other days against right-handed pitching?
Right.
You know, so if you get to the point where you feel like you need to put Santana on the IL or you need to put Gonzalez on the IL, whether it's before or after the All-Star break, those are two of your options going forward. I think those are probably the first two, along with Michael Chavis. Those are the guys who are sort of the de facto taxi squad at this point. If Boston was likely to promote a position player, it would be one of those three. If it's a pitcher, it's going to be Tanner Houck, who they've talked about potentially introducing into this hybrid piggyback multi-inning role out of the bullpen that Garrett Whitlock currently occupies.
Right.
You know, you could also use Houck in right-right matchups. If you feel like his third pitch isn't far enough along, if you feel like his splitter isn't necessarily good enough to face a lineup full of left-handed hitters as a starter, you could certainly look and say, okay, we're playing the Yankees. They're right-hand dominant, let's say. Can we bring him in the sixth inning for Martin Perez or Garrett Richards? Have we bought enough time? And we have Houck face a right-handed dominant lineup with a fastball slider for six outs. Can we use him as a bridge to the late-inning guys in the bullpen? So you've got three or four guys in Worcester at this point, even before your injury situations started to pop up, who could be interesting additions to this team as you go forward into the second half.
It's nice to be able to look down at the AAA club and know that you've got some bodies there that can actually contribute and help. I mean, Red Sox have not always had that luxury. They've sometimes had some very bare cupboards when it came down to farm systems.
Yeah.
So this is something that clearly has been a priority for the front office. And, you know, it is certainly the mark of a good team when you have some reinforcements that, that you can call up. So hopefully if you need to reach down there, there will be players who will be serviceable and can contribute to the team. So, Bill, it would be remiss for us to get too far away from this last road trip and this particularly this last series without talking about the greatest player of all time, apparently, and that is Shohei Ohtani, who is on his way to the All-Star game. And I say that because there is a there was a recent column by Bill Plaschke on the West Coast calling him basically the you know, one of the greatest players or the greatest player ever.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
So, Bill, I mean, he is an amazing talent, an elite hitter. I was looking at his numbers here. He's hitting .279. He's got an OPS of .1064, 32 home runs, 69 RBIs, 81 hits. And by the way, he pitches too, and he's pretty good as a pitcher. Now,
yeah,
you know, he's an elite hitter and a very good pitcher, or a good pitcher. It really is amazing when you think about the workload that just a regular major league pitcher has to go through. And here's a guy that does that and, oh, by the way, is an everyday player and is a an anchor in your lineup.
You know, we laugh and we kid because Bill Plaschke is an unabashed homer, and he's been in the L.A. market forever. And, you know, he was leading the Dodgers parade, you know, at the 2020 World Series. And, you know, he was first in line to call the Astros cheaters and bums and say that they should be vanquished from the face of the earth. You know, so he ventures into hyperbole every once in a while. That's
right.
Sort of his artistic license as a columnist. But in this case, you know, you're talking about Shohei Ohtani and the player he is in 2021. You can legitimately say, Bill, that no one living currently, unless you are into your 100s, has seen anything like this before.
Even if you are into your 100s, you know, back then, they weren't as dominant on both sides of the ball.
No.
You know, I mean, everyone talks about Babe Ruth, but Babe Ruth really only sort of did it for a few years, and then the Yankees realized, hey, this guy can really hit.
Yeah.
Let's stop with this pitching nonsense. But so far, Ohtani is doing both.
Now, we haven't even seen teams attempt the usage, and I think it's because it's just such a daunting task when you think about it, when you itemize his day.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know how, you know, we look at, you know, great pitchers and people who come to mind in terms of great preparation are like Curt Schilling, who would, you know,
sure,
really study opposing batters, and J.D. Martinez, who would really study opposing pitchers, besides having just the God-given talent, just really putting in the work to improve yourself. I mean, I don't know how somebody like Ohtani can be as good a hitter and still focus on his pitching preparation. It's not as though you don't do anything between the 5 days that you pitch, right?
That's
not
right.
You're just sitting around. I'm like, I might as well go play. I mean, you're warming up and you're throwing bullpens and you're studying opposing lineups. Oh, by the way, he's also the designated hitter on those games in between. It's really remarkable in this day and age. And you were saying before our podcast, you know, college, we see two-way players in college. You know, but not in the pros. Once you, if you're fortunate enough to be drafted and get into a major league organization, you kind of have to declare. They kind of figure it out. Okay, what do you want to be, kid? And then that's the track you're on. And, you know, I think, you know, probably the fact that he didn't come up through an American college system and didn't have to go through that, you know, and he was in Japan and they just sort of let him do what he was doing because he was so good at it. He never really had to just declare. He got to the point where he was elite or damn good and at both. And at this point, it would be harmful to stop him from doing one or the other.
You know, I think that's a good point, Bill, that you make. I think, you know, there has clearly been a focus on Ohtani and his development with respect to the total player, the total package, all of his skills,
yeah,
whether it's pitching, hitting, playing the outfield as well. The fact that he's a terrific athlete. For someone his size, you know, you look at a guy who's 6'4 and 210 and who runs gracefully and looks good doing it.
Right.
You know, doesn't look stiff, rigid, sort of, you know, you see pitchers sometimes they get on base and they're running and it looks
right
off.
Right.
You know, this guy looks like a position player while he's out there. And you know, I see it covering high school sports here in America. You know, a lot of times baseball players, even as early as high school, are specialists. They might pitch and not play the field. You know, they might only close if they are going to pitch.
Right.
You know, you get into college and you have very few guys who are legitimate two-way players, and a lot of those guys are specialized. If you're someone who is an elite talent, a pitcher who's recruited to, you know, an SEC, an ACC, a Pac-12 school, you're pitching.
Yeah.
That's it. You're not going to be the DH after you make your Friday night start.
Right.
You're not going to be in the lineup the next 2 days. And I just think, you know, as someone who's covered baseball for a few years now, we obviously get to the ballpark, you know, much earlier than fans do. So you see the work that these guys do in between starts, and the fact that, you know, you're out there playing long toss and you're throwing bullpens and you're getting treatment and, you know, you're going through workouts and whatever else. Pitchers have enough to do to get their bodies ready every 5 days, 30 days a year. You see the number of injuries on pitching staffs in baseball, not just in 2021 because you're coming off an unconventional year, but previously, these guys break down. It happens. Now you couple that with the fact that Ohtani goes out, he throws his bullpen between starts, and then he comes and takes batting practice.
Right.
After he stretches and receives treatment and maybe gets a lift in,
yeah.
You know, and he's in the batting cage, and he's working on his craft at the plate. He's sort of a baseball decathlete, I think would be the best way to say
it.
Yeah,
that's a good description.
You know, and Alex Cora, the way he described it was, is he the best hitter? No, probably not. Is he the best pitcher? No, probably not. But what he does is a combination of the two. He's the best player. It's just ridiculous, the array of skills that he's able to bring to a baseball team. The fact that he's pitching to a 3.49 ERA, he's got 87 strikeouts in 67 innings, opponents are hitting 195 against
him. Yeah, he's a very good pitcher. It's not like he's just some guy who you know, who can just come in and be the fourth or fifth pitcher on your staff. He's a really good pitcher.
He'd be the number two starter in the Red Sox right now.
Right.
Clearly, he would start their second playoff game behind Nathan Eovaldi.
And he would lead the and he does. He leads the league in home runs.
I mean, there are plenty of other staffs in the league where he wouldn't be any worse than two or three.
Yeah.
You know, some others he'd be the ace. So it's just phenomenal. He is a phenom. I think we put that label on too many people.
Yeah, but he
sometimes.
Truly is.
We widen that net too much, but he's just incredible. He really is.
You wonder, Bill, how long this will, you know, like at what point, you know, how old is Ohtani?
He's 27.
Okay, so
he turned 27 this week.
So he's pushing, you know, another couple of years, he'll be 30. And you wonder, okay, at what point does that not make sense for him physically? I don't know. I mean, we've never seen this before in the major leagues in forever. But at some point, do they say, okay, you've reached a point now where we really have to kind of figure it out, which one?
Well, he's already had Tommy John surgery once, you know, which isn't unusual for pitchers. You know, they've already sort of shifted him out of the outfield and made him a DH.
Mostly, yeah.
You know, he's not really a position player anymore. Mm-hmm. So there have been some concessions, I guess you would say.
Yep.
You know, he's made 13 starts. He's only at 67 innings. So he's not putting in a ridiculous workload
right. On
the mound. You know, they're not burying him for 7-8 innings every time out there. You know, he's not going to work as much as, say, you know, a Jacob deGrom would, a Zach Wheeler would. You know, they're not just going to put him out there and expect length every single time. If he can give them 80 pitches in 5 innings and he strikes out 10 and they're ahead 3-0, okay.
Yeah.
Fine. That's good. Because you're in the lineup at the same time. And if you've homered twice, you've done more than enough to help us win on that given night. You know, so I think, you know, certainly you have to manage him. You have to be certain that he's diligent about his workouts, his recovery, you know, whatever sort of stretching, you know, action in the training room that's required. You know, any sort of between starts, off days, you know, over the All-Star break, you're going to be very careful how he's used, how he's burning through his energy, because there are only so many hours in a day. There's only so much he can prepare. You can't expect him to be at the ballpark for, you know, 9, 10, 11, 12 hours and think you're going to do a full pitcher's workout and then a full hitter's workout, and you're going to throw a bullpen, and you're going to throw through BP and whatever else. You can only do that for so long. You know, but I think, you know, I'm much more someone when it comes to Ohtani. I'm someone who's willing to stay in the moment and just appreciate who he is now and not necessarily think about, can he do this until 2026?
Yeah, no, sure. Obviously, we should absolutely appreciate what we're seeing because it is phenomenal. But you just wonder, at least I just wonder, you know, how much longer this can... I mean, he's not an old man, but, you know, you wonder if he's going to be doing it past the age of 30. And I'm sure the Angels are taking whatever they can get right now because it's just phenomenal. I mean, it's not just great to watch. I mean, he's clearly helping the team.
Well, and to be fair to you, I think I have the same thoughts, and I certainly would be having them if he was playing for the Red Sox. You know, because I'd be looking and I'd be trying to project positions going forward. You know, who do they have coming through as a pitcher?
Right.
Could they sign a DH on the market like a JD Martinez and put Ohtani at first base, let's say, and all of a sudden you have another elite bat in the lineup? Like, you would be doing those sorts of roster gymnastics as someone who covers the Red Sox or as a Red Sox fan. As someone who watches Ohtani play for another team and is a baseball fan, I put my baseball fan hat on. I am just thrilled at the fact that he is healthy and that he is doing something that I have never seen before and never believed a major league player was capable of
and
doing.
And we may never see it again. And you wonder from his standpoint, you know, if he gets to the point where people are saying, okay, you know, we've got this pitcher coming up and we think your future is as the DH or whatever. He might say, well, I don't think that, you know. So maybe he's looking for a different team at some point because he wants to continue to do both, you know, so he'll find a team that'll allow him to do it. So anyway, I mean, that's down the road. For the moment, we're going to watch him put on a show, hopefully, for the American League in the upcoming All-Star Game.
And in the Home Run Derby.
The Home Run Derby.
In Denver.
Fantastic. Yeah.
They've announced that they will not be putting the balls in the humidor, by the way, at Coors Field.
Good move. Good move. Absolutely.
You're going to see golf balls going out of there. If you're on that big concourse beyond the left field stands, or if you're in the upper deck in right field, you're going to get some action at this thing.
It's going to be fun to watch, absolutely.
What I think is they want to see someone hit it in those center field seats or above that little park they have
out there. Right, right.
Those purple seats with the mile-high row through the middle of them. I don't think anyone's ever hit it up there.
Yeah.
You know, it's got to be 500 feet from the plate. I mean, it's a mile.
Wow.
But if you're looking at some of these Home Run Derby participants, and Ohtani is squarely included in this category because he's one of the big boys in terms of power, you could see somebody go up there.
He really is, though. When he swings, he doesn't. It's not like he gets you know, these little bloop hits or he's a slasher.
And, oh no!
I mean, he hits the ball a ton. He puts that 6'4", 210 frame into every swing.
No. He's violent up there. He's in the top one percentile in Major League Baseball in terms of exit velocity. He's in the top one percentile in terms of barrel balls. You know, he is certainly a guy who can hit it as far and as high and as long as anybody else.
Yeah.
No question.
Yeah, it's going to be great to watch. It'll be fun to watch him and the rest of the guys just teeing off in gravity-less Coors Field.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
It'll be fun. So speaking of the All-Star game and the All-Star break, if you're looking ahead at the Red Sox schedule as I have, I noticed that the New York Yankees are on the schedule 8 times before the end of July.
Mm.
4 times at Yankee Stadium, I believe, first, and then I think the Yanks come to Fenway in late July for a 4-game series as well. So, Bill, it doesn't happen often, but this might be one of those rare opportunities where the Red Sox, if they continue having the same kind of success that they have had against the Yankees this season, which is very rare, that you know, the Red Sox could essentially bury the Yankees here in July. Now, I understand that mathematically they would not be eliminated, certainly, but as a practical matter, if the Red Sox go 6-2 against the Yankees in these next 8 games when they're facing each other, it's hard for me to see a path for the Yankees to come back for and win the division?
Well, you face two very real questions. You know, the math, which we alluded to earlier, which you're going to force smoke to come out of my ears here again, aren't you?
You don't have to get that detailed about it.
But, you know, just in realistic terms, okay, the Red Sox are 54-34 right now. They lead the American League East.
Yep.
You know, if the Red Sox get out to 60-40, let's say, and the Yankees are 50-50. We're just going to use nice round numbers, okay?
Yep.
The Red Sox have a 10-game lead with 62 left, which means if the Red Sox go 31-31 the rest of the way,
mm-hmm. which they've shown, you know, that they've given you no reason to think they're just going to play 500 for the rest of the way. But okay, let's say they do.
The Yankees would need to get to 91 wins somehow. They'd need to win 41 games. Out of the last 62.
Yeah.
That means 41-20.
Yeah. That's pretty.
41-21.
Yeah. That's an amazingly high bar.
It's really good.
Yeah.
And it runs counter to everything they've done to that point. So yeah. The math starts to close in. The Red Sox could really start to close the door on New York with just Tampa and Toronto really leaving it open. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, what if the Yankees decide to sell? What if Boston comes out of the break,
right,
kicks him in the teeth twice? You get to the trade deadline on July 30th, and Brian Cashman says,
"Yeah, we ain't getting there.
We're all done.
Yeah,
this isn't going to happen. We're all done. We've got some major free agents coming up, some major arbitration guys coming up. Maybe we're going to start over."
Which would make those 8 games with the Red Sox even more. You know, carry even more weight if, in fact, that the Red Sox do kind of bury them or win 6 out of 8 or whatever, and the Yankees' prospects are even dimmer.
You know, they've got serious problems in terms of their roster. You know, we talked about it a little bit the last time on the podcast, the fact that they're sort of inflexible and they're locked into some things. Now, the Yankees can, COVID-19 or not, you know, financial losses are not last year. The Yankees can spend whatever they want. They could spend through the tax. Don't let anyone fool you and say, oh, the penalties are too much and, you know, they don't have the money. And, you know, all right, you lose 10 spots in the draft if you go through enough thresholds of the tax. We're not going to do a deep dive into the CBT here. But the fact of the matter remains is that the Yankees are a multi-billion dollar entity who can spend whatever they want.
Yeah, of course.
You know, they could run up some debt against future earnings. They can do whatever they want. So don't think for a second that New York has to have a fire sale because they're not going to go to the playoffs and they're going to lose money and who knows what's going to happen later on. And, you know, they can't afford Gerrit Cole and Giancarlo Stanton and DJ LeMahieu all at once. That's just a lie. That's ownership spin. Don't believe it for a second. But in terms of player development, you have some real questions going forward in terms of if you'd like to offer some of these chips to a contender, and if you could get big prospects back for them. Aroldis Chapman's really struggling right now. It looks like he's going to lose the closer job in New York to Chad Green. He'd only have 1 year left in his deal. He'd have some team control there if you want to trade for him and you're a contender. Big salary. The Yankees could eat part of it. Who knows? He could probably return you an A prospect. But some of the more interesting guys coming up, like Aaron Judge. Aaron Judge is a free agent in 2023. Are you going to commit to him long term? If not, the return for him is much higher with a year and a half left as opposed to if you get into this offseason or if you get into next July's deadline and you decide to trade him. Gary Sanchez wouldn't have much value right now. Luke Voit isn't a free agent until 2025. Huge team control.
Yep.
Do you decide, hey, maybe we're going to sell really high on Luke Voit, his stock's not going to be much better at any point. Gio Urshela is the same thing. He's not a free agent until 2025. He'd have significant value on the trade market to someone as a third baseman if you say, hey, you know, this guy's sort of out here. 2024, he'd be a free agent. Mm-hmm. Do you decide to move on from Gleyber Torres? Have you seen enough? Do you think he's not going to come back?
Right.
Are you going to look at another organization and say, good luck trying to rehab this guy? Who knows? Now, I don't know necessarily if they would put any of those guys up in conversation with opposing organizations, but if the Yankees do decide to sell, and they decide to sell, you know, pretty much en masse,
right?
And you deal even one or two of those guys, you'd make a significant impact on your farm system. You'd be bringing back real blue-chip prospects
right.
from a potential contender, and especially for the guys who still have years of control left, like Judge, like Voit. You know, so I would think if the Red Sox can come out and do something damaging to New York, go 6-2, 7-1, something like that, they would certainly have to reevaluate where they are ahead of the trade deadline.
It's even amazing that we're considering that because, you know, I'm sure not many people, certainly not me and you, when we were talking about the Red Sox upcoming season a few months ago, were thinking it would really be more of a Rays Yankees kind of race for the top of the AL East, and the Red Sox are probably somewhere in that third place mix, you know, and
yes,
here we are a few months later, and it looks like the Yankees may not even really be a factor. And certainly, if the Red Sox do go 7-1, 6-2, there's a real threat of the Yankees basically just selling. Although it's hard for me to see them parting ways with Aaron Judge just because of what he's meant to them and the fans. But yeah, who knows? Who knows? So, Bill, this Sunday before the All-Star game gets going on the break, I guess on Monday, the game is Tuesday. This Sunday, the MLB is holding its draft. I believe it's Sunday the 11th, I want to say. Is that right?
I think that's right. Okay. That sounds right.
Yeah, I think it's
the 11th
up.
To the 13th.
Yeah. Yep.
That sounds right.
So, usually, this is not something that I pay that much attention to because it's the baseball draft, and the Red Sox typically don't pick very high, and it's baseball because it's not basketball or football. So, these guys that are drafted, first of all, nobody knows them, and second of all, it takes them a long time to kind of get to the major leagues, unlike football and basketball where they're, you know, top draft picks are playing the next season.
The distance is
right.
The factor.
But this year, because the Red Sox won all of 13 games last year, or whatever the hell it was, the Red Sox actually have a pretty good draft position. They're in the top five, and that hasn't happened in a long time, right?
Yeah, I think fourth is the highest they've picked since 1967.
That was a good year, by the way, for the Red Sox.
Yeah. Did end up being
66 was not a good year for the Red Sox. But
no.
Right.
No,
right.
I think they finished ninth in a 10-team American
like
League,
that.
Correct?
Yeah, which is probably why they got a top five pick. And last year, they were horrendous, and they got a top five pick again. And
We were talking about it before we came on the pod. to think of how terrible they were last year. And that there were three teams worse.
Yeah, that's right. They weren't the worst team, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that is atrocious.
Yeah. Right. And you know, it was a generationally bad team.
Horrendous.
Yeah.
Worst ERA in franchise history.
But still better than three others.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It really is.
So, Bill, what are your thoughts on the upcoming draft? I know there's been a lot of talk about the shortstop, I would say Mayer.
Marcelo Meyer,
out of California, and then of course Jack Leiter, the Vanderbilt pitcher, and then there's another Vanderbilt pitcher that's getting a lot of buzz.
Yeah, Kumar Rocker,
right? So is this the year the Red Sox go all in and put all their chips on one guy?
Yeah, it's interesting how they can approach this. There are a few different ways that they can think about this. You know, first and foremost, obviously, you have the fourth overall pick in the draft. You haven't picked that high in more than 50 years. It is a major asset for your organization. You are expecting to bring in a premium player here. You know, someone who could have significant long-term value for your organization. You look at the pick that they made in 2018 with Tristan Casas, and now, you know, he's their top prospect. He's a top 50 prospect in the game, consensus. You're looking at a guy who could be their first baseman as soon as 2023. He looks like a hit in that respect. Sometimes it's not so guaranteed. They took Trey Ball 7th overall.
That's right.
Most people listening to this podcast don't know who Trey Ball is because he washed out of the minor leagues in 6 years. He never got above double A. He was a left-handed pitcher from Indiana. They tried to switch him to outfield at some point just to keep some of his value. Yeah. That didn't work either.
Right.
So it is not a guarantee in terms of taking guys in the first round, you know, regardless of how high you pick. You know, the first pick overall could be a bust. You know, somebody like Matt Bush, who was a high school shortstop, who they tried to turn into a pitcher, who obviously had some addiction issues off the field and has battled those. You know, we hope that he's healthy and okay at this point. You know, and I don't use those issues, you know, solely to make this point, but it's just to illustrate the fact that yes, you do a lot of work on these guys. you think you have a good evaluation of who they are as players and who they could be as people. But they're just so far away from the big leagues, generally. They're not all going to be Andrew Benintendi, who's a year and a half, let's say.
Yeah.
And they bring him up, and all of a sudden he's there and contributing to playoff teams. You know, so there are a lot of different ways that development can go. It's not a linear process. You know, and so I look at Boston, and I think you have this great asset. You're picking fourth. You know, you could decide to take who you think is the best player available and sign him for full slot value. You could also decide to do something like they did last year with Nick York, who was their first pick. He was 17th overall in an unconventional year where they didn't have a second-round pick. You drafted a guy who saved you some slot money, and then you reached a little bit in the third round for someone who you thought would be difficult to sign. You allocated York's money to Blaze Jordan, who's a power-hitting third baseman out of Mississippi. You know, so as we, over the next few minutes here, we'll get into slot value and the money stuff and all that, what it is. But I would say just generally the Red Sox drafting fourth, I think, is really exciting because you have a chance to make a major splash here.
Yeah, and chances are you're going to get one of these players that can have an impact on your organization. And there's so many ways to go. I mean, there's some shortstops here in the top four or five draft picks. So maybe these guys are shortstops that will take over for Bogaerts, or maybe these guys are players that you convert to second baseman if Bogaerts is still there. You know, clearly you can never go wrong by drafting pitching. If the pitcher works out, every team needs pitching, and you've got at least two players here that are highly regarded. You would think maybe one of them would still be there at four. So there's lots of sort of options, but Bill, with baseball, teams are not allowed to kind of trade their draft picks, so to speak, right? So there's a formula or sort of rules as to how much you pay these draftees depending on the slot position and stuff. So how do the Red Sox navigate this, and what are their options?
Okay, so just generally, an overview on Major League Baseball and the draft. Each team is allocated a bonus pool based on where they finished the previous season. The Red Sox have about $11.9 million to sign their draft class for next year.
Because of how bad they were last year.
Yes. The Pirates, who pick first, have a little over $14 million.
Because they were even worse.
Right. Now, you divide that out into each pick and what's called a slot value. So the first pick in the draft overall is expected to get, let's say, $8 million. The second pick is expected to get, say, $7.8 million. Mm-hmm. The third pick is $7.6 million, and so on and so on and so on, mm-hmm. all the way down. Players look at that. Players' agents look at that as sort of the measuring stick of where they are and how much they're valued by an organization. You know, someone like Casas signed for full slot. He was a 26th overall pick. I think it was about $2.8 million. He was a high school player who was committed to Miami. He could have honored his commitment to Miami and said, you know, thanks, Boston, I'm all set. I'm going to go play college baseball unless you go over slot, unless you pay me $3 million or $3.5 million or $4 million. The Red Sox are perfectly within their rights to do that. But what it does is take money out of your bonus pool for other players.
Right. So the more you give one guy, the less you have for somebody else. You cannot exceed the money in your bonus pool.
Correct.
Total.
You can do it by 5%. MLB gives you a 5% overage. Mm-hmm. After that, you start to pay taxes and you incur penalties, much like you would with the CBT if you go right. over your payroll threshold. Right. You know, so teams are mindful of that when they're drafting high school players and when they're drafting underclassmen in college. They have a certain amount of leverage. They don't have to sign with you. The high school player can go to college. The college player can stay for another year if he'd like, potentially another 2 years with COVID waivers being what they are. College juniors, and I think it's college-age sophomores who have already turned 21, are eligible for the draft. You know, but teams tend to make this up on the back end when you have college seniors who don't have any leverage at all.
I see, yep.
Would you like to play pro baseball, or would you like to go be an accountant?
Right, right.
You know, would you like to sell products for Coca-Cola? You know, would you like to be a pharmaceutical representative? Or are you going to go into that finance job that you have lined up? Mm-hmm. Or would you like to come play in the minors? Here's $2,500 and a bus ticket.
Right.
If that's your seventh round pick, that's way, way, way under slot value for a seventh round pick, which would still be into six figures.
Yep.
So you take his slot money and you put it towards your first round guy who's committed to Mississippi State, who says, I kind of want to go to Starkville. They just won a national championship. I'm from the South. I want to play baseball in the SEC for a couple of years. I want that college experience. So we rewind to last year, where the Red Sox only had four picks in a five-round draft. Yep. They lost their second-round pick because of the Alex Cora scandal in Houston, and then ultimately in Boston in 2018, when the Red Sox were found to be committing much more minor skullduggery in their own video room.
Right.
The Red Sox were docked the second-round pick, and they were docked the bonus money that went with it. So they looked at Nick York, who was a fringe top 100 prospect, according to Baseball America and MLB.com, and they took him 17th overall. They signed him for about $900,000 under his slot value. They looked at Blaze Jordan in the third round, who was a Mississippi State commit, power-hitting third baseman, kid who had won a home run derby at a couple showcases. Just his raw tools suggested that he probably should have been at the back end of the first round, high in the second round. Teams are looking at a five-pick draft. They're thinking, would we be able to sign him? We'd probably have to go over slot to do it. The Red Sox did. They took the money that they saved on York.
Yep.
They applied it to Jordan. They got a guy who they think is an impact player in the 80s. You know, I think he was 88, 89
right.
overall. You know, and then they spread the rest of the way. I think they signed their last two picks for full slot, and they were at mm-hmm. the cap on their pool. So Boston this year could look at the first pick that they have, fourth overall, and they could say, okay, the slot value is, you know, whatever, the low sevens in terms of millions. We have this high school kid or this college senior who we really like, but we're not necessarily going to go all the way for him like we would have to with someone like Jack Leiter,
right.
Henry Davis, who's the catcher out of Louisville. You take the best college senior in the class and you say, we'll give you $4.5 million. Do you want to keep playing baseball? Hmm. It's a fair price.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to be $2,500.
Right.
You know, because the only real recourse that draftees have is if they sit out a year and they don't sign, their rights are up for anyone. A year is a long time to sit.
Yeah.
Who knows how you're going to train? Who knows how you're going to... Luke Hochhaver actually did that. The Royals right-hander, I think he was on their World Series team in 2015, mm-hmm. Was drafted really high, decided he didn't want to sign, you know, and just sat there for a year. I think J.D. Drew might have done the same thing,
wow.
actually, when he was picked by the Phillies.
Hmm.
He's an outfielder at Florida State, if I want to say, and just said, no, I'm not going to sign with you. And that leads to J.D. Drew having batteries thrown at him, you know, on his return to Veterans Stadium. Aren't they lovely?
Surprise! Phillies fans would behave like that.
And ends up being picked by the Cardinals fifth overall the following year in the draft. Mm. So that went over great.
Worked
I'm
out,
sure.
yeah.
Everybody. but I guess you could say, you know, just generally, it is a very complex equation going into the draft. You know, Boston has a lot more to work with than they have at some points in the past.
Right.
Could really bring in an impact player with that first overall pick. The guys who you're going to hear, Marcelo Meyer and Jordan Lawler, are two high school shortstops. Meyer is a California kid. Lawler is a Texas kid, Dallas area. Henry Davis is a catcher from Louisville, an offensive player, someone who they're not necessarily certain will stick as a catcher. But if you think back to Blake Swihart, the value that he would have offensively compared to if he switched to, say, first base.
Mm.
Someone like Joe Mauer, someone like Buster Posey. You know, how much better they were offensively than other guys who were catchers.
Right, right.
As opposed to if you shift them to first base and they're a little more average.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Henry Davis could be that type of player. The right-handers from Vanderbilt, Kumar Rocker and Jack Leiter, they both had good years. Leiter had the better year. Leiter is the son of a major leaguer, Al Leiter, who pitched for multiple teams in the World Series.
Forever.
You know, major pedigree yeah. there. Rocker has been a star since he was a freshman on campus with Vanderbilt. He threw a no-hitter in the NCAA tournament. I think it was against Duke, and I want to say he struck out 19 wow. in that game. Big kid, power fastball, power slider. Had some questions this year in terms of his velocity dipping off at times, being a little hittable at times. He didn't have a great start at the College World Series. Leiter, you would look at and say he's only 6 foot and 190 is he going to be able to last, you know, the rest of his career? Is he going to be able to be a starter for, you know, 12 to 15 years in the big leagues? Should we take a risk on the fact that he's a little small? You know, so there are, and that goes back to the fact that, you know, there are holes with all of these guys that you'll be able to find, injury being chief among them, certainly. Sure. But, you know, the fact that it's going to take them a little bit of time, and you are making a projection long term about who they could be. In the NFL, you're drafting a starter in the first round.
Sure.
If the guy doesn't start the next year, it's a failure.
Yeah, it's a bust.
You know, if the Patriots take Tomlin and he's not, I mean, just look at N'Keal Harry. First-round pick, demanding a trade after 2 years. If he leaves New England in a trade, or if he plays out the remainder of his contract and puts up numbers like he has the first couple of years, he is a major bust.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are a lot more guys in the MLB draft, like N'Keal Harry, than there are like Gerard Mayo, like Vince Wilfork, you know, like Drew Bledsoe, frankly.
Yeah, it's so hard in the Major League draft. It really is, because that path to the majors is longer, much more complicated, and I think it's much harder for scouts to be able to look at a player and project that person, project that player as a major league player at a particular position for whatever reason. So, yeah, you know, we'll see. But it is exciting that the Red Sox have such a high pick, which is very rare for them. It's one of the probably the only good thing that came out of last year's horrible season is that you may get a few good players that otherwise you would not be able to get out of the MLB draft. Bill, we have hit the magical 1 hour mark, so we're going to turn to pumpkins soon. So
wow.
We should wrap up the this latest episode of the Twin Bills with the All-Star break. And baseball taking a pause. I think we're going to take a pause next week, and our next podcast will come a week later. It could be from on location. We'll just leave it at that for now. The old cliffhanger at the end of an episode. So we'll see.
Interesting.
Who knows where that location might be? It could be just back here in the studio, Bill. So who knows?
I like it when you scheme, Bill Corey. I'm a big fan of this. I like this.
So get your popcorn ready for the Home Run Derby at Coors Field on, I guess it's Monday. They usually do these things on Sunday or Monday. No, it'll be Monday. Yeah, Monday.
Just wild to think of a Home Run Derby at fantastic. Coors Field. It really is.
And then we'll see, hopefully, a good All-Star game. We'll see some Red Sox representing their team, and hopefully nobody gets hurt, and we're able to get into that second half of the season healthy and ready to bury the Yankees.
Absolutely.
Bill, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.